Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast, a podcast about classical Dungeons and Dragons. If it's in a box, we'll talk about it.
Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast. This is Vince sitting in, just doing some post-editing here. This is an interview that myself, Liz, and Mike sat down with Tim Cast, a legendary writer. We decided to put this in one show itself because it was such a long interview, and if anyone was interested, they could just listen to this episode and download it itself. All right, guys, hope you enjoy, and we'll see you for the next episode real soon. Thanks. So, Tim, let's step back into 1970s here when you first got hired by TSR. How'd you get involved with TSR? How'd you get hired by them as the full-time editor?
You'd have to go back to late 73, early 74. I was playing chainmail at a game club in Carbondale at Southern Illinois University. And that's where I met Tom Wom, as an aside. That's where I met Gary Chiquette, Jake, who followed me at Dragon. We had a rules kind of an interpretation or something like that, and as all miniatures did back then, we made a house ruling and went on. Okay, and I think right there is a very interesting foundation pillar of old school D&D, of the way it was created, was the house ruling. That's just what we encourage DMs to do. Make a ruling and go on. Okay, and that's where that's the big part of the miniaturist tradition that D&D strings out of. And anyway, in any case, back to the story. I saw the thing in the back of the book where it was printed and everything. I thought, you know, how many people named Gygax can they possibly have living in a town that size? So I called up Director Assistance and got the number, and I called him up one evening, and I said, "Hi, my name's Tim Cask, and I don't know you. We've never been introduced. I'm a chainmail player and a wargamer, and I was wondering if I could ask you a couple of questions about chainmail." "Sure!" I could hear him sitting down, you know, and settling in, and we talked for about an hour about chainmail. And one of the things that I didn't notice it at the time, but I came to see it was part of the way Gary talked to people, was whenever we talk about a rules interpretation or something, well, what'd you do? How'd it work? Okay, he always encouraged people to make a house ruling. Well, what'd you do? Did you like the way it worked? Okay, that's very, very deeply grounded in miniatures play. Because if you go back to the beginning of miniatures play, you had to have a referee. Mm-hmm. Okay, there was a judge, a referee, who called the shots, decided where the cannonball hit, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And lots of times that meant one guy didn't get to play. So miniaturists would often play with each other and, you know, not have a referee. Oh, shoot, let's just play, you know, let's just play.
Yeah,
and so that's where house rulings came from, because if you had a referee or a judge, he just made the call and you went on. But when you didn't, you worked out a house rule that you could both live with, and that's the way you played. Usually from then on, that was precedent, much like our legal system works, precedent. So anyway, yeah, you know, we talked for an hour. "Hey, great talking to you. Yeah, call up anytime." You know. He enjoyed it, too. I was a history minor, and we had a lot of things in common, and, you know, we just talked. We read some of the same books. And so, over the course of the next couple of months, I called him several times for this or for that, just a couple of times just to BS, because he said, you know, "Yeah, let's do this again." And we talked about fantasy authors that we both enjoyed. We talked about movies. We talked about miniatures. We talked about different rule sets. You know, and we found we had a lot in common. We played a lot of the same games, you know, et cetera. I was, you know, communications major, and already had, you know, publishing, editing, newspaper publishing in school, you know, experience in college, you know. So he started telling me about this new game that he'd come up with. New game being D&D, of course. And tried to explain it to me. Well, it's miniatures. Because, you see, D&D came out of miniatures play. D&D came out of chainmail through Dave Arneson's mind. Okay? I mean, Dave took chainmail and made it into something else. Showed it to Gary. Gary made it into something else, and that something else became D&D. So it was, you know, twice filtered, but it originally all stemmed from chainmail. So, you know, he's trying to explain it in terms of a miniatures game. And I said, well, you know, what are you fighting? You know, because if you're playing miniatures, you're not there to walk around the court square. You're there to fight, you know. And he's going, oh, well, it's orcs and goblins. I'm going, orcs and goblins, where are you getting these? You know, thinking they're figures. And he's going, no, he says, you just play it in your head. Use paper and pencil to make maps, and the rest of it's in your head. And I was like, yeah, okay. And he encouraged me to come up to Gen Con in August of 74. So I lived, my wife and I were both born in the Quad Cities. That's Moline, Illinois. And that's about two-thirds of the way between Lake Geneva and Carbondale. So we decided we'd go up with our daughter, and I'd drop my wife off and continue up to Lake Geneva, and I'd go to this convention for a day or two. Well, had no idea that, that place, that part of the country, if you don't make reservations weeks and weeks and weeks in advance, you ain't going to stay nowhere. So I only ended up staying the one day. And I played a couple of miniatures games and won them both. And back then, you used to get trophies and stuff. And so, you know, Gary noticed that, and we chatted a couple times. Hey, hey, fine, you know, face of the name, that type of thing. And then I played a couple of pickup adventures. Neither one of which, well, the first one didn't last but about an hour, and we were all cut into little one-inch cubes by some laser thing. And I'm sitting in the back of the group going, I don't know what happened, but this was kind of weird. And half hour later, somebody's walking down the hall at the walking down the hallway in the horticultural hall. Got a game starting in 10 minutes. And I go, okay, well, this is Gary's game. I'll go give it another shot. And this one, I don't know. I'm a dwarf, you know, and I'm like, okay, that's cool. I was kind of in the dwarves back then anyway. I was trying to build a fantasy army of heritage dwarves at the time, and back when I still had to pay for stuff. So I was trying to build one because I had to pay money for it. So I got into this other one, and I'm a dwarf, and we go along, and we rescue this dying dwarf, and I'm the only dwarf in the party, and so he gives me this medallion, and now I'm the heir to his kingdom, and yada-da-da-da, and I'm going, this is still weird, but it's kind of cool. So I'm thinking about this, you know, okay, well, all right, I've been lasered up into little tiny cubes encased in some sort of air-permeable lucite, apparently. And I just became the king of a bunch of dwarves. I got 80 fighters behind me, and I'm thinking, you know, it's in chainmail terms still. I got 80 fighting men, you know, I got a keep. Oh, man, this is pretty cool stuff. So I bought a set, and I bought a bag of dice. So I got the little round box and three books and a bag of dice because Greyhawk wasn't even out yet. And took it back to Carbondale. I told my group, we're going to do this. I played this really cool thing.
And of course, you already had chainmail, right?
Yeah, we had chainmail. Yeah. And, we've been playing chainmail miniatures. So I told them it'd be in a couple of weeks, and it was actually more like four because I read the three little brown books line by line. And then I drew up levels, and then I followed, just like everybody else that didn't know any better, or until they did it the first time, I did what I refer to as a slaughter at the zoo. It's since become known, I guess, as a dungeon crawl, you know, something behind every door, let's go kill it. Because that's what, until you learn to think out literally outside the books, outside the box, that's what the rules and charts said. you went, you know, you built a hall that had, you know, it was 200 feet long, and there was 16 rooms on various sides, and you went on each one, and you do the dice tell me there's anything here?
This is Yeah, I've heard of that referred to as a funhouse dungeon too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I call it slaughter at the zoo. You just go from cage to cage and kill whatever's in there. Hey, three camels. What do I get? You know? And then you cut them open to see if they've just accidentally swallowed something. I mean, that's, when you first saw that game, if you were the person buying it, as I was, that's what you did the first time.
That's what I did the first time.
Well, and that's because that's what it tells you to do. And actually, for my group, it worked quite well because we were just slaughtering things left and right, having a great time. Some of them were, you know, some of them were dying. And when you're second, third level and you get croaked off, it's like, yeah, okay, no big deal, I'll start again, you know. And it was after they started hitting fourth, fifth, sixth level that they started looking to save their skin. But for a while, we just played like that. And all this time, I'm talking on the phone with Gary about every 3-4 weeks.
That was back when long distance was pretty expensive, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, and so we were calling late at night. Okay, I was calling, you know, after the rates went down, after 10 o'clock, after midnight, and it would be after I think it was probably after 6 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday, and after 10 o'clock during the week, something like that. Anyway, whenever the rates were lowest, we'd get on and we'd talk. And basically, you know, he'd ask for a blow-by-blow of the last, you know, however many sessions we'd have. And so, you know, how'd this go, how'd that go. So we basically functioned what I now know as a playtest group. Okay, we were basically testing stuff. You know, it was always, you know, well, how'd you do it? How'd it go? How'd it work?
Quick question.
Sometimes it would be, this is the way I do it.
Yeah, quick question, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
I've heard a lot of people talk about how confusing the first three Brown books were, as hard to understand. Did you find it hard to understand, or did the fact that you had actually played it already kind of help bridge
them? No. If you were not a miniaturist, they would be very dense. They would be very dense. They would be very, very, you'd be wading in mud to your knees. Because they came from miniatures. Miniaturists thought in terms of distances, movement distances. They thought in terms of rolling dice for results. They thought in terms of taking damage. Because back then, miniaturists, the army scales were grossly different. Troops were all mounted on bases. Depending upon the system that you played in, if it was heavy infantry, it would be three figures on a base that was 5 inches wide. Because they were, miniaturists were used to occupying volume. And then those three figures might actually represent 80 men or 8 hits. And so we used to use those little tiny, those little tiny glued rings that you put around your notebook paper that had torn?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we would put those over the bayonets or over their heads or whatever.
Oh, cool.
And when that stand got X number of hits, it was removed. Hmm. Okay, so if you were a miniaturist, digging into D&D was not nearly as difficult as it would have been if you were just simply a gamer or not a gamer at all. It would have been intensely intimidating because it was very dense. If you were not experienced with using those type of spatial references, blast radiuses, area of effect, okay, those all made perfect sense to miniaturists. Whether they were flinging cannonballs or chucking trebuchets full of flaming oil, all those things had a direct corollary to a miniature.
Yeah, I seem to recall that the first didn't like the first wizard spells say a fireball, they basically said treat as a catapult.
Yeah, you'll have to ignore that. That's somebody trying to get in on my call waiting. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Did you hear me?
I can't.
Or should I repeat that?
Okay, I'll just have to tell Cheryl Carroll called. Now, all right, now, what, the fireball, say, okay, yeah, I got distracted. I heard part of it.
Okay, basically, you were talking about the thinking in the miniatures mindset. I seem to remember hearing somewhere that the original, say, fireball spell, you were basically referenced to treat as a catapult or a lightning bolt as a ballista.
Well, I never saw it referenced as such, but I can see where people would accept it, having already used a mechanic similar to it.
Okay.
Okay, because again, remember, one figure wasn't one guy. One figure was, you know, maybe 10 or 20 or 50 if in the battle you were recreating. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's why catapults had blast effects. It wasn't just one catapult. It might have been actually four. It wasn't just one cannon. It might have been a battery. And so those things had blast effects. And so any figure, and that's why the basing was crucial, because we had templates, and any figure whose base was touched within that blast radius was liable to damage, just as you find in fireballs and lightning bolts.
Cool.
All right. And that is the same, but that's just really more of a physical mechanic similarity than I think a conscious design.
Right.
Because, I mean, let's close your mind there a minute and go, yeah, shoot lightning off my fingers. You know, it's not going to arc. It's going to zap right at them. Ballistas had very little arc. That's why they could skewer three guys. That was a flat trajectory weapon. Lightning would have to be a flat trajectory weapon anyway.
Cool.
So, yeah, I can see where it might have been easier for us to accept that because we subconsciously had a corollary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, yeah, that's legitimate. Okay, where were we before that?
We were going to go to another question here about do you still play, and what version of D&D is your favorite to play?
Do I still play? No. Unless you count the DMing I do at the conventions.
Well, that's
counts.
Play.
Yeah, that counts.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do two or three sessions of up to 12 people at a time at each of these little cons I go to. The one in Texas, the Gary Con. I do a special group event for a collector's group, the ACAM. You've probably heard of them, or ACM, mm-hmm. I think they call themselves. It's supposed to be Latin. But anyway, they're a bunch of good guys. And they always take me to dinner every year at Gen Con and for stories for food. So the last couple of years, I've run an adventure for them. They get a hospitality suite at one of the hotels, and I go in and I run an adventure for them. So I was working on that prior to going on the poker site, waiting for you to call. I have to have it done in time for Gen Con. but that's the playing I do. Next year, I've agreed to, there's going to be a special event next year in Texas where Doug has talked a bunch of us designers into being the players and gotten one of his guys out there to be the DM. And so we're going to have like an all-star dungeon crawl, Monty Hall bash thing, I think.
Cool.
That would be interesting. I very seldom play on the other side of the screen. I played twice on the other side of the screen before I became a DM for 16 months.
Hmm.
And I DM'd at least 80 times during those 16 months, at least 5 times a month, and it's probably closer to 100.
What's your preferred version of D&D, though I suspect I know the answer to this one?
What has now become known as OD&D, the original D&D the three little brown books and the little brown box and the four supplements. That's what I play.
I've heard it occasionally referred to as basically if you play it with the supplements, it's first edition light. Would you agree with that? And if so, why or why not?
No. No, because I edited the supplements, and that was not the intent. The intent was to expand upon the game. And if you read my forewords in Blackmore and Eldritch Wizardry and Gods, Demigods, and Heroes, if you read my forewords, you'll see that we were just throwing out new stuff. The psionic system that came out in Blackmore. Gary and I were big fans of Doctor Strange comic books. This guy's always going out and traveling through the cosmos, you know, and had the silver string that tied him to his body. Well, gee, where'd that come from? You know, you look in D&D, and there it is. You know, the strain, if it gets snipped, you're gone, you know.
The and his hoary host, thing. The Thogoth?
Well, all the astral travel thing with the silver string, that all came straight out of Marvel Comics' Doctor Strange. Okay? I mean, everything is derivative to an extent. We freely admitted that we lifted ideas wherever we found them, which is why we credited as many fantasy writers as we always took pains to credit. Because if they looked at our stuff, they knew where we'd gotten this idea or that idea. And they weren't straight lifts. A lot of time they were just inspired by it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously, because of our close association with Fritz Leiber, you know, he was, and you know, doing his Lockmar game and all that, you know, we were heavily inspired by Fritz Leiber's Fafhrd and the Mouser stuff. Heavily inspired, and that's, you know, that's very apparent in the old game that it was that swashbuckling devil may care. We'll jump to that other question right now because we're here at this point. The old game, the swashbuckling, the craziness, the exuberance. Here's the scenario. There's three of these really ugly things in here. And enough loot to make you witch beyond your wildest dreams for the remainder of your life. You have a 1 in 3 chance. You know, the old days? Yo, let's go for it! You know, risk beyond our wildest dreams. We'll be the 1 out of 3. You know, I mean, that was the spirit of the game.
Yeah.
Now, my take on 4th edition.
Uh-oh.
It's become so charted and tabled and tabulated and databased that 63% chance that we'll have no return on this. No, I think I'll pass it up and look for something better. Whoa! Where's the sense of adventure? Where's the sense of, you know, any well-playing party can have their way with the best DM if they're smart enough. And any party's collective consciousness, that zeitgeist, whatever that is that happens when a party starts clicking, you might have 7 people sitting across the screen from you, but by God, it feels like you're thinking against 12. Okay? That's what I find exciting. That's what I like to see engendered. But no, they've reduced it to charts and actuary tables.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the Holmes boxed set, which was what started me off, in the preface, it specifically says, you know, that it is in general not bounded by the conventional limitations of other types of games, you know, and, you know, it basically gives you carte blanche to make your house rules and to modify it so that, according to the people who are playing it, you know, it works for them. And I think that gives you a lot more freedom.
And it's a lot more in keeping with the original spirit of the rules. And let's talk about the Holmes box for a minute, why don't we?
Okay.
I was I was getting around on somebody else's site, a bunch of other sites. I sometimes go lurk on to see who's saying what or whatever. Somebody is doing a breakdown of the Blue Box set.
Ah, Grognardia.
Yeah. And I'm not knocking him, because I truly believe that too many people today do not understand what it was we were producing when we did that, and they have no concept of the market that we had to aim at. And recently I was asked to comment about Dr. Holmes, and then he died, and I said that I will not speak ill of the dead. But he did do some great things with this book, and since I got my master's in education, I have a greater appreciation for what he did. We had a product, a game, that was getting wildly popular, and it had started virally in colleges, high schools, and the occasional game club. My group was absolute dead ringer exemplar of how D&D spread in those days. I went, I bought one set, I came back, I infected 12 other people, 5 or 6 of them bought sets for themselves. Okay, after I left, 2 of them took over the old campaign. Okay, and they kept playing, and every year new people got infected in that club. Okay, or inoculated, or call it what you will. All right. But
inspired.
What we had a product that was becoming really, really attractive to much younger players. We're going out of the high school into the middle schools, age-wise. And let's face it, OD&D was a life-or-death struggle that involved lots of violence. And we were not nearly as inured to violence in our children and in 1975, 1977. We didn't have all these hideously violent video games. Pong was not violent. Okay. Kids, the movies, they were just, it was a different type of child that we were writing for. And what Dr. Holmes did was come in and take out the life or deathness. And that's why you can't compare the Blue Book to the other books, because eventually the Blue Book became the foundation of the, what I've come to learn, because this all happened after I left, come to learn was the foundation of the stepping stones into the game, the Blue Book, and then some other book, and then the Red Book, and okay, and I don't pretend to have all those down in my head, but I have read enough comments of how people got heavier and deeper into the game. That's exactly what the Blue Book was supposed to do. The Blue Book was supposed to make it accessible to younger players that did not have the reading background that we could expect of a high schooler or certainly of a college person that had a bent for fantasy. They didn't have the cartoons. Okay? So he made it a lot less life or death, but still fun.
Well, that's how I first got inspired in the game, was the Holmes, though I immediately teamed up with some people who were playing Brown Book, but it was the Holmes box set that first got me introduced. I hadn't read, I think, anything much beyond Tolkien at that point.
Exactly, and an awful lot of people hadn't, and that's why what he did was he made it accessible to a different type of child that was not, you know. One of the things that we did reaction to criticisms, because those early years we were very, very sensitive to our critics. The game burnings that some fundamentalist churches had, the thing with the kid that was supposedly lost in the steam tunnels,
The Dungeon Master, the one written by William Deere, the PI.
Okay. Where were we? Oh, all right. Well, I don't think it's fair to pick apart the Blue Book and say, well, the Blue Book says you do it this way, but then this book says you do it that way. Well, The Blue Book was a basic beginning immersion. Hi, let's all wade up to, let's go a little over our ankles, why don't we, and see how we like it. Okay? Ah, you like it? Good. Now we'll go to OD&D, or we'll go to AD&D.
So it was more kind of a...
It was just meant to be waiting. We weren't asking them to jump into the pool with basic, because a lot of them were kids, and we were sensitive to the fact that people were then still sensitive about inuring kids to violence, and they thought it was too life or death to, you know, have 9 and 10-year-olds involved in. And in 1977, they had an absolutely valid argument.
So you'd say maybe that the Holmes Basic set was, in a way, kind of a introduction to role-playing to a degree, and then once...
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it was light, because it wasn't real big gun and heavy on the killing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Not as.
Okay.
And it wasn't as involved.
I was going to say that pretty much... answers one of the questions that I had submitted for this interview. I was planning on asking you what differences you saw between the Holmes box set and the original Brown books, but you've pretty much answered that question, what got taken away and why. So,
well, let me clarify something. After... after we rolled up Basic, which I had, let me back up a second. I wrote about this about a year ago, I believe, on one of my threads or answer. Gary and I had for some time been discussing the trying to hold the lid on the game, escalation, inflation of character levels, many different things. Okay, we were trying to figure out how to do this. We're also trying to figure out how to make it accessible for younger kids. We're trying to figure out how to corral all the various rules that we had introduced in all the various supplements and sift it all together again and make a comprehensive system. So on a Wednesday or a Thursday, Gary told me to clear my schedule the next week. I said, what do you mean? He says, clear it. Don't have, you know, where are you on the magazine? I said, I'm 2 days from going to press. He said, good. Clear your schedule next week. I said, okay. Came in Monday morning, went into his office. We were in the old gray house. And he had scavenged every bulletin board out of the entire building and had them screwed up and nailed up all over his office. We had a stack of D&D, all the supplements and all the, you know, we had about six sets of D&D. And we had scissors, and we had staplers, and we had a big bin of push pins. And for the next 6 days, we sat and we cut those up, and we went over the rules, line by line, page by page, do it this way in basic, this goes to advanced. And we segregated, we separated, we established. Advanced went to John Eric Holmes. After that point, I never saw it. But this is how we decided, all right? This is where Magic Missile got changed, you know? Everybody has such a freak out about Magic Missile being changed for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Well, I confess it's my fault. I did it.
Stone him!
I made it always hit as I thought it should.
There are legions of magic users that bless your name for that, I'm sure.
Well, honest to God, Gary and I used to have some of the most amazing discussions out of nowhere. I was his sounding board. And again, I playtested for him for a year and a half before I went to work for him. So we knew each other rather well, and we certainly knew how the other played and how the other thought. And, we talked about Magic Missile several times about... And we would use examples out of books or movies. Yeah, but what about, boy, that was pretty cool, you know. And so we finally decided that it would always hit. It just wouldn't hit as much. But, yeah, damn it, if you're a wizard powerful enough to do that, then, by God, you're going to hit what you aim at. And we logicked it. that we logicked it. If you're powerful enough to be able to fling it, you're going to hit what you aim at, for goodness sakes, because you're tough.
Yeah.
And so it's my fault. But anyway, from that point on, I saw nothing in BASIC. We just knew the direction we wanted to take with it. I'd been in on one or two discussions with Dr. Holmes out of several that he and Gary and Brian had. I'd only been in on a couple of them. And
so it was the BASIC stuff that went to Holmes and...
Yeah.
And Universal again.
Yeah.
Okay, you'd said advanced earlier, but I figured that's what you meant.
Yeah, BASIC went to Holmes and advanced went to it went back to Gary, who then typed furiously for 10 days. And we had everything all written out. And yeah. I typed for a couple of days, and then I had to get back into the magazine because, you know, you can't, once you're on a schedule, you can only squeeze time, usually the week after you go to press. And, so I typed for a couple of days, and then the manuscripts went to my car, and then after that point, I backed away, and I was totally involved with Periodicals Division, and a couple of other games that I did do development work on, but I didn't have any hands on to D&D from or AD&D from that point on. Recently, I've been pilloried for hating AD&D. How could I possibly hate the AD&D? I helped create AD&D. I was the midwife to AD&D. Just because I don't choose to play it yet, I play the old version, OD&D.
Yeah, that's your decision, yeah.
And nothing wrong with that at all.
I'm an AD&D hater. I mean, I've had people tell me, hell, he hates AD&D. I don't. I just don't prefer to play it. It's all right. But if Frank was running an AD&D game at a con and I was doing nothing and he'd say, hey, Tim, I got a hole. Sure, I do that and I play it. Hell yeah. It's just not what I prefer to. It's not what I prefer to DM. Because right. I feel it's restrictive.
But I'll admit,
if I want my giant spiders to have 11 hit dice, then my giant spiders are going to have 11 hit dice. But it might have two. I don't know what AD&D says. Five? I don't know. You know, I don't care.
Yeah,
have an AD&D.
Not to put words into Frank's mouth, but having played his AD&D game a couple of times, you know, he's not 100% by the book, and I don't see a problem with that personally.
No. No, I don't think any... I would be horrified if we were turning out Stepford Wife DMs. That would be horrible. All of my forwards on the supplements that I did contain a line similar to the effect of, you know, these are only meant to be, you know, D&D's not meant to be, it's only loosely bound by the rules. Something to that effect. In fact, there's one of those out of Eldritch Wizardry that several people use on their signatures on Dragon's Foot. You know, right. It's like vindication.
Well, Tim, yeah. Apparently...
And that's the whole thing, you know, it's all about having fun. If I had a piece of advice to give to a DM, what would it be? My advice would be to look at your game and ask yourself a couple of real simple questions. Are they leaning forward when you're describing what's going on? Do they show up on your doorstep every week? If you can answer one of those, you're doing pretty good. And if you can answer them both, yes, you got it right. Whatever you're doing is right. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay. If they're involved, they're leaning forward. They're not lounging back and eating Cheetos. You know. I mean, they may be leaning forward and feeding Cheetos into their face, but you know what I'm saying. There's a body posture that indicates involvement and. I've always felt that I just write the outline of the story and I throw a few plot elements in the hat and I let the players finish the story. And if they're involved and leaning forward, they're finishing the story for me and they're having a good time. And if they do it every week, then you're a perfect DM for your group. And that's all that matters.
Definitely.
Y'all having fun? Doesn't matter. If y'all having fun, you got it.
Yes.
Pat yourself on the back, give yourself two gold stars. I'm dead serious. I say it lightly, but I'm dead serious. It's no more difficult than that.
Well, part of the reason I'm chuckling is because it's so simple and yet so profound.
Well, but now the danger is pandering to your players.
Well, yeah. Well, even that gets dull after a while, even if they're getting everything they want.
Well, I've read a couple of rather shocking posts that I've refrained from responding to that basically say that it's the DM's fault. If PCs die, it's the DM's fault that he didn't give them an adventure commensurate with their abilities.
Oh.
Whoa, where did that come from? If there's not a chance of dying, why bother?
Exactly.
This is an adventure fantasy role-playing game.
Step right
You're up. Never more alive. You're never more alive when you know that you could die.
True.
I figure DM is doing a huge favor just to say occasionally, are you really sure you want to do that?
Sure.
I don't expect anything more.
Well, several people that have now played in two or three of my games at various cons over the last couple of years have now learned to pick up on my facial clues, because I'm there to have fun with my friends. I'm really not there to kill them, except at the Tower Gygax. I was very proud of having... I killed 42 last year.
Woo-hoo.
And they seem to be delighted. I don't understand. People come to these things. Do they come to die, or do they come to outthink me? Either way is okay. Just let me know, and I'll give you a glorious death if that's what you're there for. I listened to a guy on Sunday bragging how I'd killed him five times in the Tower Gygax.
Ah, nice.
He was tickled to death. Wow. Okay. You know, if that's what you're there for, then I'm glad to give it to you. And, you know, it's just like signing a book. Why wouldn't somebody want to sign a book? You know, 20 seconds out of your life, you give somebody a memory and you make them happy, and they walk away half an inch off the ground. Why wouldn't I?
Yeah, for humbling. A while, I remember Gary Gygax.
It's very humbling to be able to do that.
Yeah. Gary Gygax was running some games at Gen Con, and I remember hearing that, you know, a lot of people went in there just to die so that he could sign the death certificate that was on the back of the one each sheets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have taken to when I do these little events at Texas and Gary Con, when I write these, I always create monsters. I make new stuff up for every adventure I write, because nothing bothers me more than a player that sits down and you describe something and you go, oh well, that's a two-toed horned ape and it has X number of hit points. No, you never met this thing in mind before. We're going to be like the old days. You're going to learn what some might call the hard way, but you probably won't die. I'm not there to kill you. Just there to remind you to play smart. Just there to remind you to play smart. Well, anyway, I always print up a sheet that at Gary Con, we called it Gary's Virtual Porch, in honor of the games that we used to hold over there. He used to hold over there at Texas. I just did a sheet, and it says, you know, I journeyed to the yada-da-da, whatever, and then it has a blank for I survived or I died hideously.
And, I've still got mine from your game last year.
Okay. Well, you know, hey, if that gives people something to play with, that's I'm all for it. You know, we have a good time. If you want a keepsake of it, that's fine. I'm all for it. You know, at this point in my life, hey, whatever floats your boat, and I'm glad to provide you know, something like that. I'm glad to sign things that people bring up to me if I had anything to do with them. You know, I don't sign things that I didn't do or have a part in or my name isn't in or something, you know, like that. Did you see that book that came out a couple of years ago, the 40th anniversary of Gen Con, that hardbound?
Yeah, I got a copy.
I must have signed 300 of those. That was amazing. And I was real embarrassed by it because I had no idea I'd been quoted so heavily in the book until it came out. My wife read through it and said, didn't they talk to anybody else about this? And I go, I guess not. I was the only one that would talk about the old days of Gen Con.
All right, Tim, we're going to do our last question for you tonight and let you go because we've taken enough of your time up today. And
I don't have a problem. If you've got a schedule to keep, fine. Otherwise, go ahead. I'm fine.
Well, the question
if you're running out of tape, that's fine. Okay. We haven't covered half of what you had here on your list.
We wanted to ask you if the current Wizards of the Coast that currently are printing D&D, if they said to you, Tim, here's the key to the Golden Room, which edition of D&D would you like to print again and run over again and remake as your own baby, what would you do? What would you promote?
Well, I'd take the original form that tells you that don't get hung up on the rules.
Sounds like a solid answer.
That's the type of gaming that I espouse at these conventions. That's what I write about. Give me OD&D in the supplements, and the only thing I would do is correct the grammar and a couple of the inconsistencies that we know we made mistakes, not somebody else decided they didn't like it. I would rewrite the forwards and tell people, hey, these are just ideas, these are just things to play with, it's play, dig in, have a good time, and if your guys show up every week and they lean forward at the table, you're doing it right.
Yep.
You know, if everybody goes home with clay on their fingers, you're doing it right. That's all it is. Somebody wanted to talk about Dragon. What about Dragon?
Liz.
Is that Liz?
Yes, Liz, go ahead.
Was that me?
You're up now. You wanted to talk about Dragon and adventure gaming?
Let's see. Oh.
Adventure gaming was a crushing defeat. I absolutely went under in the recession after Reaganomics. We were making money every month on paper and not being able to collect it. I lost my shirt and finally had to close it up.
Mm. Well, we have the first 10 issues. I think it went 12 or 13?
Mm-hmm.
And as reading the earlier issues, I was struck at how much it seemed like the old Dragons.
Well, I like to play games. And so I made a gaming magazine, you know. That's what Gary and I were on the same page from day one of what Dragon Magazine, actually day minus a year. Because we started talking at some point in time about my degree being in, them going to be needing an editor, and he needed an editor, and, you know, all this good stuff, and about coming to work for the company. So you don't have an 11 and a 12? I think there's 13. I don't know. I may have a couple of those. I don't know. Anyway, we started out from the beginning. We wanted to grow the pie. The gaming industry was of a certain size, and there were so many companies lined up around the pie. And rather than try to elbow the guy next to us to get a bigger piece of his pie, we figured let's just make the pie bigger. And, you know, if everybody's got a 2-inch slice on an 8-inch pie, and then you go get an 11-inch pie, your 2-inch slice is a whole lot more bites of pie. And this is the metaphor Gary and I use, you know, grow the pie, grow the pie. And so we saw both Dragon and Little Wars as a way to grow the pie. Because as we attracted new people into fantasy, they might decide to check out historical gaming. And, you know, vice versa. We just wanted more gamers. We really didn't care. And at the time, we had no idea that D&D was going to so dominate the growth that it was going to be the growth, that fantasy role-playing was going to be the growth. I mean, everybody grew, but not like our side of the fence did. And Adventure Gaming Magazine was the same thing. I like to play games. I play all kinds of games. I play card games. I play I don't play but one fantasy computer game, and that very seldom, besides and then Civilization when I'm bored. But
I do that too.
Yeah, well, I'm up at like 1981, and I'm 3 years from my surplus engine being done, and I'm so powerful I could kill the rest of them, but it's just too boring now. I think I'm going to start again. it gets to a point where it gets tedious is what it is when you've got 80
you know you're dominating
80 infantry
so.
Units. 80 infantry units in your army and 75 armored units. It's just tedious. But anyway, I play games, and so the old Dragon magazine was all about games. A lot of there are several articles, and don't ask me which ones because I probably couldn't tell you, that Gary and I did in the old magazine about non-D&D games that we wrote either under our own names or under other names.
We could find some possible
maybe
articles that might really be the two of you.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you about No Good Deed Going Unpunished. I had an ad that didn't come in. I can't remember if it was an early Dragon. I think it might have been the last strategic review. I had an ad that didn't come in. So I had X number of inches that I had to fill. And, I mean, I was screwed. And I wrote late at night, semi-delirious, stream of consciousness. I wrote this really goofy article about what to do when the dog eats your dice.
I remember that.
I wrote that under a pseudonym, Omar Qualish. And that article haunted me for years, because I had people coming up and telling me what a wonderful, hilarious, and I'm going, oh, Jesus, I did this at 3 a.m. for years I heard about that. And there were others, silly ones. Yeah, I mean, Gary wrote articles about Rail Baron and Monopoly, we put them in Little Wars, we put them in Dragon, and then after we folded Little Wars back in and Dragon truly went to an all-gaming magazine, we knew what our readership was, X percent fantasy, X percent historical, yada-da-da-da, so much crossover. And so we tried to pattern Dragon to snare as many of those as we could, to increase our sales. We had an enormous pass-around factor because of our varied content. They would do circulation surveys, we had one of the highest pass-around factors in the country. Basically, for every copy that we sold, 7 more people read it.
Huh.
So if I'm printing 10,000, 80,000 are reading it. Well, the other manufacturers, the other game companies, they're beating down the door to buy ad space, and I would only sell a certain percentage until I could afford to add another folio, to the magazine, because I was not going to, make the magazine ad heavy. It always maintained a pretty close ratio of material to advertising. And when I get enough, then I'd add 4 more pages, or 8, usually 8 more pages. So anyway, adventure gaming went down because that was the time that all the little mom-and-pop hobby shops and all the small distributors went belly up.
Mm.
Think about it. Think about your hometown, the little hobby shops and that. Okay, Reaganomics killed a lot of the little mom-and-pop businesses. Hobby shops took a particularly bad hit. Because I was, I was seeing them go under. I was scuffling to get new circulation and losing every month because other distributors are filing bankruptcy, other stores are going out of business. This is a tough time.
Yeah.
We were well received critically. And I had advertisers lined up because they knew, that I would put out a quality product. But we had some problems there too with one of the people that was involved in the early stages of it. So, interesting story. Let's see, what else? What do I play at my own table? I play whatever game looks good. Tuesday night, I'm going over to the local hobby shop, and I'm going to see if I can't get enough people to play Circus Maximus, but maybe I'll start a racing league, and we'll play every month. I love Circus Maximus. Of course, I'm known for taking that around to the cons and running the thing.
Speaking of cons, are you going to be at Gen Con this year?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Of course. I'll be showing at the auction. Let's see. Miniatures. Somebody had some how I use miniatures in my games. In the old days, we never used miniatures in D&D. My group never did the whole first 8 or 9 months until maybe somebody came back from a convention with something, because there weren't any to speak of, unless you had last ones or something like that. Nobody was doing individual figures. There weren't that many guys that painted except the guys that were playing historical miniatures and that. So if we had a melee situation in a wide open room, well, you're the orange dice and you're the yellow one and I'm the blue 12-sider, you know, and that's what we did. We didn't play on grid mats, you know, or anything like that. It was all in our heads, but we would range the dice. You've played in my games. You know about my standard operating procedures, my marching orders, all that kind of stuff. That's where all that came from. Okay? We developed those things as we played, and that's why I ask people to do them today, because it makes combat flow better. There's no arguing about who was standing where when something happened. Okay? Something like that. But we didn't have minis. Now, having said that, I miniaturized other games besides Circus Maximus. I had a relationship with Avalon Hill. Tom Shaw, the president then, knew that I loved Circus Maximus.
And okay, so that is the Avalon Hill Circus Maximus.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. There is no other that I'm aware of that's a board game.
Well, I wasn't sure now, if it was that one you were using for your miniatures or maybe a homebrew or something.
Oh, no. It's straight up second edition rules.
Okay.
One of my maps is a straight copy of the board game, blown way up. The other one is a custom map that is a total of 44 squares longer than the standard map. That's what we run. That's what we will start running the feature races on, and that's going to make people have even 44 more squares. I'm not going to increase endurance the straight same percentage that I'm increasing the length of the track. So they're going to have to start paying a little more attention to that and quit flogging each other and save it for their ponies. Let's see. I miniaturized. I had at one time. 60, 70, Civil War ironclad miniatures. Yakinto used to put out a great board. Well, it did. They're still out there. They have a great board game called Ironclad.
I've seen that.
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful game. It is essentially. There are several like it in that it is essentially a miniatures game converted to counters. All right, there are other games like it, but Ironclad is very heavily miniatures oriented, measuring distances, arcs of fire, etc., etc. I saw that and I said, "Oh man, miniatures! Wow, look at this!" So I went to a blueprint place and I had big maps. I took in arcs of fire. And I had acetate transparency made, so I could lay down next to the ship. You know, we could see the arc of fire and extend it out, whether or not they could shoot at something or whatever. So I converted it to a miniatures game, and it was just straight Yakinto rules. They had another game. They had Ironclad, and they had another one that was a wonderful miniatures conversion. And I have a theory about. Games like Axis and Allies and other games that use plastic pieces, formed, injected toy pieces. I think there's a tactile stimulation that some gamers get from being able to play with the pieces, literally. And there's nothing wrong there. I mean, play is an underrated thing. Play, you know, we all need to play once in a while. And I think that part of the attraction of Axis and Allies is you get to play with the little tanks and half tracks. Part of the attraction of Viking or Sword and Axe, you got these little Viking guys. Part of the Shogun, you got the little Japanese guys, you know, the Ashigaru and whatever. I think those games appeal to the play instinct in a lot of us, and I think that's why they're so successful. And the fact that they're decent games to begin with, you know. I remember when Axis and Allies came out of somebody's basement. And those really thin counters that, if you picked them up wrong, they were jammed under your fingernails like bamboo splinters.
All right, Mike. I'm sorry, Mike. Do you have any last questions before we get going here?
No. Well, nothing to do with classic D&D, so I'd probably better.
Well, what other questions you got?
Go ahead, Mike. He wants a good question. Yeah, give him a good question.
I got time, guys. If you do, my wife's gone off shopping and stuff, so it's all good.
Well, how about we wrap up the recording, and then I can just chat directly with him.
Sure. All right, Tim. Thanks for joining us on this interview. And if anyone wants to contact you or they want to follow you, do you have a maintain a blog or do you write somewhere generally? Or
well, I have a thread on dragonsfoot.org.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's org. I have a thread on dragonsfoot.org. Q&A with Tim Kask if they have a game related question or something like that, or you know, anything that's not really terribly rude or personal, they can go post there. I've answered some pretty bizarre questions over there.
All right, so
come look me up at one of the cons. I'm always available. You know, if I'm not doing anything, I'll always stand around and BS with people, right. Especially if they're going to feed me good food or I can be bought. All right, turn off your recorder.
Have a good one.